Lights are blind here. Great. Thank you very much. Again, thank you so much to the organizers. It's been terrific. And Tarana and, pardon me, Kristen and Hannah, thank you so much. Also to the other organizers who have been helping with this. It's a huge amount of organization. And Anna's really brought a great group together. So a lot of people, I've really admired their work. They've been an inspiration for me. And thanks to the audience for coming out. I'm looking forward to a good conversation. It's probably fitting that I'm going now because I'm going to revisit Hannah Arendt's work on the nation state, and I'm also going to end up where Ramsey has brought us to as well. So I think maybe we're both in the same plane here where we're having certain resonances of Time of Monsters in Canada. Just living north of the border in Toronto, it's having particular resonances for me in terms of the monsters that we're dealing with, the white supremacist and misogynist politics that we're seeing there, and the way that that's coming in into the Canadian context as well, in terms of we have our own conservative leadership race happening right now. And one of the, Kelly Leach, one of the people running for that, is trying to reproduce some of this anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant rhetoric that's down there by talking about a different version of extreme vetting, but reproducing Canadian values and screening immigrants for those. And we've seen certainly a rise in both anti-Semitism, I think over since 2012, about 20, the figures are around 28%. And with Islamophobia, according to the Ontario Legal Aid, about 40% rise. And of course, that ends with the shooting in February in Quebec City by a university student, a Laval University student, white supremacist, who said he was inspired by Donald Trump's words, as well as Le Pen. And so that's what we're dealing with here. And of course, I want to take that back because we know that these moments are not just current moments, but have a lot longer histories. And we heard last night, going back to longer histories of imperialism and colonialism. But I want to go back today just to two moments. One, to go back to Hannah Arendt's work on the nation state, because I think that's important to think about how migration, as Nana said in her presentation, is already problematized from the beginning through the nation state structure. And I want to bring out a couple points there. And then also to go back to another case, which I think is important in the Canadian, anyways, moment, which is with Canadian Syrian citizen Mahar Arar, who was traveling back from a family vacation on his way to New York and then subject to extraordinary rendition. So I'll come and talk a little bit about that and end up with the executive ban. So the organizers have asked us to think a little bit about the nation state and how it's become a universal mode of human political organization since the First World War, and how it's come to dominate different ways of thinking about political community. And I'm going to maybe be a bit more pessimistic in this talk, and then in the next talk I'll try to open things up a little bit more. But I want to begin with Hannah Arendt, because I think she was, she was very prescient in saying after two devastating world wars, she really kind of articulated the problem with the nation state in terms of the movement of people. And she posed the problem of the nation state in this way. She said, when an individual loses her citizenship, she also loses the ability to claim the inalienable human rights that should be hers simply by virtue of being human. This is because in order to have one's human rights recognized, one must first be recognized as belonging to this world. Sorry, I missed the slide. This was of the ban and the Quebec shooting. Just to go to look at particularly her quotes, as Hannah Arendt says, she says, the fundamental deprivation of human rights is manifested first and above all in the deprivation of a place in the world, which makes opinions significant and actions effective. If a human being loses his or her political status, he or she should, according to the implications of the inborn and inalienable rights of man, come under exactly the situation for which the declarations of such general rights provided. Actually, the opposite is the case. It seems that a man or a woman who is nothing but a man or woman has lost the very qualities which make it possible for other people to treat him or her as a human being. Here, Arendt makes a stark admission that with the spread of the idea of the nation state to all people in corners of the world as the only possible form of political community, human rights become meaningful only insofar as they can be enacted through political community, that is, under the nation state system as citizenship rights. Moreover, she argues, she says, not the loss of specific rights, then, but the loss of a community willing and able to guarantee any rights whatsoever has been the calamity which has befallen ever-increasing numbers of people. Only with a completely organized humanity could the loss of home and political status become identical with expulsion from humanity altogether. And so here I want to take out a couple points that I think are important for thinking about the way that migration is problematized right from the beginning through citizenship. I mean, first we see from this that citizenship becomes an idea that's not just about status, rights, and duties within the state, but it becomes an organizing principle of governing populations and their movements between and across states, or as Barry Hindis has spoken about this, as the international management of population. And we might note that in Barry Hindis' work, he notes, going back to last night's talks, he notes that the moment of decolonization actually brought with it a radically new way of bringing non-Western populations under the rule of the state system with the universalization of a particular form of citizenship. And we should note from the outset then that this justifies treating foreigners, treating others as with differential rights as different. And secondly, it structurally reinforces global inequalities, since if you're entitled to rights and you have to make good on those rights in citizenship, your quality of rights will be determined by, as Ayelet Shashar talks about, your birthright lottery, which is citizenship, where you're born. The other insight, I think, that comes from Hannah Arendt's work in terms of not just being about the regulation of movement, but that actually citizenship is deeply about a form of biopolitics, or some like Membe Akiyemembe might call it necropolitics, in that if you do not belong to a state, you are not recognized as counting this world as a political being. You are instead, to use Giorgio Gamon's expression, reduced to bare life or a biological being. You are not recognized as a political subject in the way that we think about now the quintessential political subject as being the citizen, and you are not recognized as even having a right to have rights. So her observations about the function of the nation-state system obviously clearly play out. We clearly see this in the crisis most visibly about the increasing deaths, particularly at Europe's borders, but as we've heard from Sandro and others, but Sandro particularly elsewhere in terms of the Americas, for example. And this is because without the protection of a state, people who arrive on Europeans' borders they're not even counted as existing, as having existence, as having a right to make claims to rights. And so into this moment, I want to compound this moment by thinking about two other ways in which mobility or governing through mobility is unraveling the nation state, but probably in more pessimistic terms, and then I'll come to the end in one where it's maybe there's more positive potential to think through. So I think compounding the problem of what Arendt identifies is really the way that we've seen governments using rights to movement and controlling mobility through different types of borders, so we could talk about data borders, as a way of controlling rights and access to mobility. And so I think the story of Maharar is very insightful, and I'm going to let him just, in his own words, explain what happened to him. We can maybe show a couple minutes of this.
Maharar, a former victim of U.S. rendition, now a human rights activist in Canada. Maharar was seized in New York's Kennedy Airport in September of 2002, and he was sent to Syria, where he was tortured and interrogated in a tiny underground cell for more than 10 months. He ultimately was returned to Canada. The Canadian government awarded him $10 million for what he went through. Maharar joins us now from Ottawa, Canada. Welcome to Democracy Now! Maharar, talk about first what happened to you. This isn't now, during this current uprising. This was during the Bush government. But how you feel it relates to what's happening in Syria today?
Basically, my experience allows me to relate to what is happening right now in terms of the massive human rights abuses, whether it's torture or crimes committed against civilians. I know firsthand how brutal this regime could be. But again, what is unique in my case as compared to what is happening in Syria right now is I was sent to Syria by the supposedly democratic government. The U.S. government sent me there against my will in 2002.
Now, For people who are not familiar with your story, and people can go to democracynow.org because we have chronicled your story since you were captured by the—well, I shouldn't say captured, because you were at Kennedy Airport transiting through to Canada after a family vacation. But briefly explain what happened to you.
Well, basically, I was transiting in New York and on my way to Montreal, and I was stopped by the New York police, and eventually the FBI showed up. And I was interrogated for about 10 hours, almost until midnight, and then I was chained and shackled. I was not read my rights. I was told I didn't have a right to a lawyer, and I was eventually accused of being a member of Al-Qaeda based on classified information that they did not want to share with me. Of course, today we know what information that is, because there was an extensive inquiry in Canada which cleared my name and gave some facts about what happened. And then I was kept at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, New York, for about 10 days, after which I was bundled on a private jet to Jordan, from where I was transported to Syria and eventually psychologically and physically tortured. I stayed in Syria most of my time in an underground cell, which is the size of a coffin, basically. It's about 3 feet wide, 6 feet high, and about 7 feet deep. It was a filthy place. It was dark. It's basically, that's why I always refer to it as a grave-like cell, because it reminds you of really a grave. And I was eventually released, and because my wife had gone on a public campaign and pressured and lobbied the Canadian government to press for my release. And eventually there was an inquiry in Canada. There was a huge outrage, public outrage about what happened to me. And the inquiry took about 3 years, and reported on about what happened. I was eventually, you know, cleared, and the Canadian government was blamed for sending false information to their U.S. counterparts.
And you were awarded over $10 million by the Harper government, a Bush ally, which is extremely interesting here, although the U.S. government has never apologized for what happened to you.
That is correct. I launched a lawsuit upon my return, both in Canada and the U.S., separate lawsuits. The Canadian government chose to settle the lawsuit immediately after the inquiry. Unfortunately, the U.S. Judicial system has been not very understanding and has been siding or has sided with the U.S. government and took the U.S. government arguments, despite all the public information that exists today about what happened to me. And on top of that, the Prime Minister Stephen Harper apologized to myself and my family for what happened to us, even though the Canadian government role, when compared to the U.S. role, is really minor, in my opinion.
Hmm. Now,
okay, great, thank you. So this, I'm always surprised, you know, I bring this up with my students. I know Canadians, we have a bad sense of history, but a lot of Canadians still don't know about this story, which is always surprising to me, and I don't know how many of you have heard about Mahara's story. It's not a unique story. There were at least three other Canadians who were also subject to a similar situation. There was a second inquiry, the Iwobuchi inquiry, which also looked into those three men's situations, although they did not receive the same kind of compensation at the end of it. And there was, of course, many cases. I know there's been a German citizen and some other European situations that have also, where people have been subject to extraordinary rendition. And of course, this is a program that was started in the 1980s, but was made official in 1995 under President Clinton. And under this directive, government authorities send a suspected criminal or terrorist to another country where he or she can be held in prison unlawfully without due process and subject to interrogation, either by American authorities or by foreign governments, and often using illegal methods such as torture. Now, upon his release, as he mentioned, he was fully exonerated. And although he is still on the U.S. The U.S. no-fly list, despite that. But one of the things that came out in the inquiry under Justice O'Connor's inquiry, which is important, is that they noted that the Royal Canadian Mounted Police played a significant role in the reason for him being extradited. And this had to do with the fact that they provided faulty information to the American authorities and later sent questions to the Syrian military intelligence when he was held under interrogation. And the reason why I bring this up is we see that increasingly governments, and you'll know this in Europe with Eurodac, with the Schengen Information System, governments are increasingly investing in all sorts of forms of digital borders, data mining, biometrics, risk profiling. And so this is an example of where that takes us to. And so in the inquiry, they look at the fact that it was a result of the unprecedented degree, I'm quoting here, unprecedented degree of sharing of information between agencies and officials through what they called a free flow of information agreement. And this free flow of information agreement took on many forms, including word-of-mouth visits, but also the sharing of memos, the sharing a lot of interview notes, for example, and they were all collected in a database called Supertext that was part of Project AO, and in this database, information was shared without the normal caveats that would have to go into this. And this is a problem that still hasn't been fully erected, as we talk about in Canada and the States through the North American Partnerships Agreements, in terms of extending the way that we share information. So this is an ongoing concern. We're talking about, for example, having a shared national entry and exit database, for example. And so one of the things that I think is significant also about this particular case is that it shows really that an unraveling of citizenship in a different sort of way, or of the nation state in a different sort of way. Because now, in the name of security, we're not just talking about defending national citizens, but we're talking about the construction of transnational categories of people who become risky through risk profiling, and through that construction, regulating their mobility. And so this very much as Ramsey was talking about with the executive order. As Divas Stasiulis and Daryl Ross have observed, dual citizens with dangerous nationalities caught up with the post-9/11 security paradigm may find themselves as unprotected persons, existing in a vacuum devoid of diplomatic penetration, human and citizen rights. So cases like Marhar Arar reveal the intent of rendering precarious their status as Canadian citizens by virtue of holding dual citizenship, or by virtue of being more mobile, in cases where their national origin places them within a category of high risk. And the other caveat that I think is important here, too, is to think about the way that, despite the criticisms and the exclusionary nature of liberal modern citizenship, nevertheless, the promise of equality, for example, Canadians under Section 6 of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms have the right to move and gain livelihood for all citizens. We would expect that. This type of belief in an equality of movement or rights is even undermined through these types of cases, where it's no longer about having equal rights as a citizen, but it's really about whether you become authorized to travel or not authorized to travel. And so the rights to movement that we even think with citizenship as problematic as it is are being undermined through governing through mobility. And so then I come back to the executive order protecting the nation from foreign terrorist entry into the United States. Clearly we see in this, the Marhar Arar speaks very clearly to what is going on here too in terms of creating transnational groups of people, racialized, based on religion, it can be based on class, who are considered to be more risky and therefore regulated. And this, of course, is not just about governments doing this, but increasingly through the sharing of information, a sort of international coordination, a coordination between governments that's involved in this. Now, those would be my two kind of ways of thinking about migration and movement and the nation state in sort of more pessimistic ways. But then coming to some of the presentations we've heard today as well, the last point I would make, of course, is that we can also think about migration as a political movement that challenges the nation state in potentially more progressive ways, as we've heard Berent and Sandro and Isabel and a number of people speaking about. So when we think about migration as a political movement, we can also think about the ways in migrants and refugees are themselves demanding rights, and particularly the freedom of movement to move or to stay against this kind of government control of mobility and mobility rights. And so we see an upsurge, everywhere outside of Europe, Europe's borders, Morocco, Turkey, through the Americas, and places like Mexico, Brazil, where we see that movements of refugees and migrants are actually challenging this idea that their deprivation of a place in the world makes their opinions and actions less significant. They are, in effect, demanding to be recognized and making claims to a right to have rights that they don't necessarily have. And so we might view this struggle in terms of... We might refer to or think of this as a form of citizenship from below, as Peter Nearsh and I have written about in an edited collection, where those without status, so thinking about citizenship also beyond simply legal status, but also as having a certain performativity, where people without status demand to be counted despite this as political subjects. And as Rancière would say, perhaps this is part of the power of the rights discourse, that it happens in this gap where not having it, you can use those the discourse and make the claims to demand rights that you do not have. And so it's in through these struggles that we see an attempt to draw attention to new spaces of citizenship and potentially enable both new ways of being political and new visions for the type of politics we wish to imagine in the world. And so the question for me then is whether movements across borders can produce a movement of the border. And I would argue here that migration as a political movement is at least forcing a question of the border itself, the division between inside and outside, inclusion and exclusion, and modern articulations of citizenship in this particular articulation, which is which we see manifest in very violent ontologies in the nation state. And that's where I'll pick up in tomorrow's panel and discussion in terms of trying to think about unruly thinking and what some of that, as Sandra Mazzadra has actually talked about, in terms of decomposing citizenship or putting citizenship in motion, how that might look or occur. Thank you.